This is Richard Roth with The Passage, a monthly show on WGXC devoted to artists and other creative types. Today I'm interviewing William McWillie Chambers, who has a long career in New York art, both as an artist and as an art dealer. For several years he had a second home in Hudson. He now has moved over to Catskill. He knows the scene backwards and forwards, and he's a very interesting man.
This is Richard Roth, and I'm here with William McWillie Mac Chambers, an artist and art dealer who recently moved to Catskill from New York City, has been in Hudson for some time. Mac, welcome.
Thank you.
So the first question I always ask is, how did you end up in Hudson or this area?
Well, I came up one fall in, it was in October, and a friend of mine, the artist Bill Sullivan, had moved to Hudson several years before, and he kept inviting me to visit and to visit and to visit, and so finally I got on the train and came up here, and it happened to be October, and the leaves were absolutely beautiful and breathtaking. And I ended up buying a house. One thing led to another. And I came for a second visit and bought a house.
So was that quick? Now, you had some experience because you'd lived in Vermont, or you'd had a second house in Vermont.
I had a second home in Vermont for years. And then I sold that in 1991. And I had been spending the summers out on Fire Island between 1991 and this was, by the time I got up to Hudson, was 2005.
Oh, so you were out there for quite
and
a few years then.
I was out on Long Island, out on Fire Island in the summertime for a good many years. I guess about 7, 8 years, something
so
like that.
So you were in Cherry Grove or the Pines?
In Cherry Grove. Oh. I rented a little apartment every summer in Cherry Grove.
It was always my favorite part of Fire Island.
I like it very much, yeah. It's very low-key, and it's like a small town. Like you
right.
know everybody, and it's fun.
Right, and it was very friendly, and people are pulling their wagon along the boardwalk.
That's right, yeah.
And so Bill got you to come up here.
Yeah, I came for a second visit, you know, a bit later, maybe a month later, and found a house that I liked. And that I had my first visit was in October, and by January I bought this house.
And then from that point, then you did fairly extensive renovations on the house, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, the house was very dilapidated, which is the reason I could afford it at the time. I didn't want to have a mortgage. You know, I was dead set against having a mortgage. So I could only buy what I could buy at the time. And so it worked out okay, and I figured I would fix it up little by little as I got the money, which is what I did, you know. And it was very pleasant. I liked the house very much, and Hudson was a nice change of pace for me, and enabled me to have a bigger studio up here in the house and than I had in the city. And it just, I met lots of new artists that I didn't know in the city already, and one thing led to another, and I later was taken on by John Davis's gallery.
After you came to Hudson?
Yes, that's right. I never knew John before I came to Hudson, before I had my house in Hudson. You know, being up here quite often, I would walk around. I like to walk, and so I like to walk around town, and I went to all the galleries all the time. You know, I always used to sort of, go in and poke around the galleries and the antique stores and that sort of thing. It's a fun thing to do in Hudson, you know. And so, and I met John just through talking to him about shows that he had and asking him questions about different artists that he represented, because his gallery was so beautiful and so, and he had such good artists.
And you had a long background in the gallery business yourself.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I started working in New York City for the Grace Borgonick Gallery in 1973. and I worked for the gallery until we closed in 1995.
I see. So you were practically straight out of college? Or
that's right. I started working at the gallery when I was still in school. I was going to the New York Studio School, somebody quit at the gallery, and I knew Grace at that point, and she asked me to work there, and I started out wrapping paintings and delivering paintings and cleaning the gallery and that sort of thing, all the menial tasks of the gallery.
Starting at the... however they say, starting at the bottom or something.
Under the bottom. But it was pleasant, you know.
Oh, I'm sure. And it was a major gallery.
It was a very fine gallery, and I was learning so much. And I met such wonderful artists. The artists in the gallery were so interesting to me, you know. They all, and most of them were elderly people at that point. You know, there were some younger artists, but mostly they were artists that Grace had handled for many years, you know. But they were all very supportive, and I really loved knowing them, that generation of artists, you know, that had come of age in the Depression, most of them.
Did she have a particular style that she...
It wasn't exactly that. She had a variety of types of art in the gallery, you know. There was no, like, for instance, it wasn't a dogmatic gallery in that respect. I think the thing that brought it all together was quality, you know, and she respected artists, and she had been an artist herself earlier on, and she painted quite a lot. You know, sometimes in later life, but mostly, but quite a lot in the 1940s and the 50s. And she had studied in Paris with André Lhote, the artist, in his academy, you know. And the gallery had several locations. She started out on 57th Street, and then she moved in the early 1960s up to Madison Avenue between 78th and 79th Street. And then that's where I first started working for the gallery.
And in those days, there was quite a large scene on Madison Avenue.
Yeah, that's where most of the galleries were there, and some were on 57th Street. Some were on 57th Street, but there were two clusters of galleries in the early 70s, the 57th Street and the upper Madison Avenue. And there were a few galleries. Paula Cooper, I think, was in Soho at that time. Uh-huh. A little bit later, the Soho thing started growing and became more, you know, organized, kind of. But Grace had been an artist, and she had worked for a gallery called the Laurels Gallery, and the man Chris Ritter had a wonderful, it was a fantastic gallery, and they published these print portfolios that Hayter helped to print, and called the Laurels portfolios. They're very famous, and he went out of business, and the artists all convinced Grace to open a gallery. She had just been working there, and she was one of the artists, but they needed a gallery. Till 1981, and then we moved down to 57th Street, 5th Avenue and 57th Street, in 724 5th Avenue, which is between 56th and 57th.
And that was also a kind of a gallery building, I think.
Yes, that's right. At that time, Robert Miller Gallery was in that building, and the Light Gallery was a photography gallery.
Famous gallery,
both of them. There was Marin Jewelry. They had antique, ancient jewelry and antiquities and things like that. They were in the building. And later, there were other galleries. Holly Solomon was in the building later, and the Krauschauer Gallery. And later than that, then Babcock Gallery moved there. And, you know, the cast of characters changed a little bit, morphed, you know, from gallery to gallery over the years, because we were there from 81 to 95.
And then did the gallery close in 95?
Yes, uh-huh.
And then you then became a private dealer.
Well, I went to work very briefly for the D.C. Moore Gallery after the gallery closed, because I was, I don't know, it was just Bridget Moore and Ed DeLuca were working at Midtown Payson Gallery, and that gallery was planning to close at the same time. And so they went together with me to found the it was Bridget's idea, basically, to start the D.C. Moore Gallery. And I was, you know, they asked me to work for them and to work in the gallery, basically. So I did worked with them for about 9 months. But then I decided to go out on my own. You know, I guess I had been working for someone else for then at that point 24 years, and so, you know, and I just felt that I could do it from my apartment. My, you know, I was working mostly with secondary market things.
And by this time, you knew lots of people.
I knew lots of clients, you know, and in the art world, you know, if you're around long enough, you know thousands of people, you know, like, and you know someone in every city, and you know someone all over the world, everywhere. You know, we used to go to art fairs, so then I would know all the galleries from all over the world, you know, and the people who owned them and worked in them and that sort of thing, and we had customers, you know, spread out all over creation, too. So, you know, you could never go anywhere without knowing some the art people in that town, you know.
Kind right.
of, it's kind of just a community, a spread out community.
Yeah. So, in the old days, were art fairs different from what they are now?
Well, art fairs are a relatively new concept in the art world. There were not really any art fairs to speak of before Basel in Switzerland, you know. And that was really the first art fair, the kind of art fair that we know nowadays, because Basel was a very prosperous but small town in Switzerland, you know, and there was a dealer there named Ernst Beiler. And he basically, in some ways, he invented the art fair, in a way, because there was no business in Basel, you know, because there was, you know, there were a few collectors, and there's collectors in Switzerland, you know, but mostly everything was going on in Zurich, in Switzerland. But Mr. Beiler happened to be in Basel. And so he decided that he would organize this event so that everybody would come to Basel, you know. And people actually did it. You know, he recruited galleries, and he worked with the city of Basel, too. They had it in, you know, in the city, like fair pavilion sort of thing, you know, and everything.
And what time of year was that?
It's always been in around in June, about the same time. It's usually just before the Venice Biennale, or like that time of year, kind of, you know, like late May or early June, you know. So anyway, but he basically invented this form because there was no business in his town, and he wanted to, you know, he wanted to generate. He was very ambitious and a very astute art dealer.
And so then people kind of bring a selection of art to these
That's
fairs.
Right. And at first, people were very skeptical of it, you know. And art dealers thought it was cheapening everything to take things they are to a fair, you know. And you know, because it just wasn't, it seemed like a kind of a tacky thing to do at the time. It reminded people of these kinds of craft fairs and these very, you know, these very snobbish art dealers didn't want to participate in anything like that. They were used to sitting in their very, very elegant spaces, you know, and every now and then entertaining some very wealthy client, you know, they weren't prepared for the public, shall we say, you know, in some ways. You know, some of the more, you know, some of the more prestigious dealers. But Mr. Beiler was one of these people, one of these prestigious dealers, but he was very wise because he didn't let in the kind of schlocky galleries into the fair. He kept it very, very selective.
And then do throngs of people also come in addition to sort of...
It became an event, you know, that art collectors in Europe look forward to, you know, because you could... The obvious advantage is that instead of going all over Europe and the United States to see the best galleries in the world, you could go to Basel for a week, and it's a beautiful city, and stay in a nice hotel, and you could see, like, all these galleries in a week, you know? And that was the obvious advantage. And I think it's still the advantage that art fairs have over, like, brick-and-mortar galleries, kind of, you know.
Right,
because the galleries are spread out, and no one has the time or means to go to all of them all the time, you know. So it's an opportunity to see lots of things in a short time.
And now it seems to be bigger and better than ever.
Well, it's bigger. I'm not sure better, you know, although it's more, I think the fairs, every fair has a different complexion, too. There's no two fairs are exactly alike, and there are many, many variants of fairs. You know, some are more like free-for-all, and some are more carefully organized and more more sort of selective about what's
in it. And now everybody has a given booth or
area. Dealer, in general, the dealers have a space, you know, that they pay for.
And that space would be, what, a couple of hundred square feet? Or?
Usually, like maybe 12 by 15. Like that. That sort of 12 feet by 15 feet. Some galleries take, you know, multiple booths and, you know, have large spaces, you know.
And then will they feature one art? I guess it depends. Sometimes they'll feature one artist. Maybe they'll have several.
It depends. There are different ways of doing it. Some people prefer to have a one-person show, you know, in their booth, and others want to have a variety of things, you know. I think that some of the fairs have been specializing in one-person shows, but I've always felt that that was that the quality goes down. So it doesn't sound like it would, you know, but when dealers are able to bring the very best things that they have to sell right that minute, then out of any artist that they have, you know, well, then everything is tip-top quality. And if it's a one-person show, especially of historic material, well, you know, maybe they'll have three or four really top-quality things, and then they have to fill in with secondary kinds of works, with B-plus kind of pictures, so it's like, you know, right. And or artworks, you know, and somehow if they're able to just bring whatever they think is the best that they have, well, that makes for me a more interesting and finer fair.
And sales can be pretty brisk, I guess, in a good year.
It can be, yeah. It varies, you know, and I think that one sells more at art fairs. Galleries do if they repeatedly do them. They do them year after year after year, the
people
same
are going
fairs.
To be expecting
because
them.
Then the local collectors are respecting them. They get to know them. You know, they're more comfortable buying from people that they've seen at the fair year after year, for instance. You know.
And so you would go to quite a lot of these fairs, I guess.
Well, the gallery used to participate in some of the fairs, and you know, we did them, yeah.
So while you were doing the gallery thing, then all this time you were also painting?
Yes. I never really stopped painting. I always painted, you know, as much as I possibly could, you know. And my work at the gallery, I started out working part-time at the gallery, 2 days a week, and then 3 days a week after a few years, then 4 days a week after a few years. And most of the time that I worked there, I worked 4 days a week. But I worked 2 days and then had a day off and then two more days. So I worked Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Saturday. So I had Thursday to paint and Sunday, Monday.
And then when you came up to Hudson, or when you were in Vermont for that matter, did you always paint when you were in the country also?
Yeah. In fact, I started going to the country, going to Vermont, to paint, really, in the summertime. You know, Nardis Wolf Kahn and his wife Emily Mason recommended me to a lady who had a house to rent up in Vermont, a lady who was a friend of theirs, and I rented her house for several years until I bought some land and built a house of my own.
And what part of Vermont was that?
In the sort of central part of Vermont, north and south ends and east and west central, like in near Ludlow, Vermont, the small town of Proctorsville.
That's the town. Yeah. And it's a mountainous place, I guess.
Beautiful, yeah, full mountains and wonderful forest and trees and things. You know, it was great for me to get out of the city.
In terms of subjects, did that change when you moved from place to place, or the kind of things you were painting?
Well, in Vermont, I did the landscape there, you know, which is a particular kind of landscape, you know. So that changed, you know. But I had painted landscape. I've done landscape paintings everywhere in Louisiana and in Kansas City when I went to school there, and Central Park. And then I did paintings of ships along the Hudson River. And I was well versed in painting outside at that time. You know, I had my organized, I was organized to paint outside and loved it. You know, had a lot of fun.
Did you grow up in a small town in Louisiana?
Yes. In a small town of Clinton, Louisiana. It's just north of Baton Rouge.
And did you start painting, or were you always, even when you were a child, were you interested in drawing and painting and that sort of thing?
I had a natural ability to draw, you know, and I can't take any credit for it because it's just something that I knew how to do, you know, and I didn't struggle to, you know, to figure it out or anything like that. I just sort of knew it. When I was a child, we had a back porch on our house that had a cement floor, and I had chalk, and I used to I covered this whole porch with drawings of a whole town with houses and trees and roads and stores and churches and lakes and everything,
uh-huh,
you know.
Uh-huh.
And I played with my cars, my toy cars and trucks and things. And all over this porch.
In the town.
In the town that I drew.
I see.
And every time it would rain, sections of my town were flood prone, shall we say, and would be washed away, you know. And there were some sections where they would stay dry on this porch, so those, you know, but when it washed away, I would redraw it all or change it or whatever. So it was an ongoing work in progress.
And at this time you were in grammar school?
No, even before I went to school.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah. But anyway, but it was quite a thing, you know. I was totally obsessed, and it was my sort of playground,
right?
In a way.
And the family understood and let you do that.
They let me do it. Yeah. I wasn't hurting anybody, you know.
Right.
And people would walk on it and everything, but I just fixed it, you know. If, you know, it was an active porch, you know, people sat on it and walked across it, and rain came into it and everything. It got swept sometimes and the chalk got rubbed, you know. But I was always very kind of conscientious and fixed it back or changed, made something new if I wanted to.
Well, it sort of made an opportunity, right?
Sure, it was an opportunity to draw more. And my mother used to bring these big sheets of orange paper, bright orange paper, that my mother was a nurse at the local hospital, and she had learned X-ray to be an X-ray technician, and she did X-rays at the hospital, and the film for the X-rays came in these double sheets, these folded sheets that were quite large. They were maybe, this old X-ray film used to be maybe 18 by, 16 by 18, maybe 16 by 20, something like that, inches, and folded over. And she always, and they didn't need the sheets of paper after the X-ray was used, you know. So she saved them for me, and she brought them home to me to draw on. And so many, many of my childhood drawings are on this bright orange paper.
Do you have some of those?
I have them, yeah.
Fantastic.
I have a lot of them, a whole trunk full.
So you have a record of your entire
I think it's output. Called Juvenalia. In the art museum, people call it that. When you have an artwork by an artist that they did when they were very young, like that.
What kind of tools did you use?
Well, crayons or pencils or charcoal sometimes or different things, you know, whatever I could find.
And then you were drawing whatever came to your mind as a kid, right?
I mean, yeah, cars or, you know, like things kids draw, houses, trees, whatever. But I could draw the houses in perspective. And you know how children draw a house and they have a chimney and the chimney goes off at an angle, at a very strange angle? But mine never did. They stood up straight like a real chimney.
And so then, by the time you were in high school, was it kind of taken for granted that you would end up going to art school or studying art in college?
Not necessarily, because I don't think that people thought of that as a, you know, I mean, no one's told me that I shouldn't study art or that sort of thing. You know, people didn't discourage me. You know, my family didn't discourage me about that, but it wasn't something that people thought about doing in our place and time.
So when you got to college, that was your course of study?
Yes, that's what I decided to study.
And you said that was in Kansas?
Well, first I went to college in Louisiana, at Louisiana Tech University in Ruston, Louisiana. It's in northern Louisiana near the Arkansas border. And because that school had a very good art department, which I remember learning so much there. You know, I was such a sponge and so hungry for, you know, because I hadn't had art classes in high school or before that. You know.
That was just something they didn't really offer.
They didn't have that in my school. You know, mm-hmm. Country high school didn't have that kind of programs, you know.
So then once you got there, you were thirsting for knowledge.
I was hungry for knowledge, yeah. And spent a lot of time in the library with books, and the teachers were terrific, you know. So it was a good experience, and I went there to school for 2 years. And then one of my teachers suggested that I transfer to a different school, to the Kansas City Art Institute. And my parents said it was okay, so then I did.
And at this time, did you have favorite artists?
Well, I did. There were some artists that remain my favorite artist, and like Morandi was one of my favorite artists, and Matisse also. I don't know. Some stay with me, you know, that I still like. It's so harder for me to have favorite artists anymore because I like so many things.
Just so many, you know now.
And Arp, too, was an artist that I discovered in college in Louisiana and in the library and became one of my favorite artists and remains one of my favorite artists. To me, they struck a chord, so I say, it's hard to say why, you know. And now, you know, it's when someone asks me who were my favorite artists, you know, it's impossible, you know, because I'm so appreciative of so many artists now. And the longer I do it, the more I respect the other people who do it and do it so well, you know.
Do you follow the contemporary art scene in New York City thing?
Sure, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I'm very curious, and I love to go around to the galleries and see what's going on, you know. I don't always know, you know, what people are doing, you know, when I go in, and especially, you know, I go run around in Chelsea to the new galleries and look at the young artists and things, and I'm not always sure what I'm looking at, you know, but I decided a long time ago not to be judgmental on the spot about things. When I go to see other art, you know, I try not to close doors on things, and because I like liking things more than disliking things and grumbling. I don't like to grumble about things that young people are doing. You know, I don't want to be one of those old codgers who hates everything new, you know. So I find that if I just let it all wash over me in the galleries or in the museums and think about it later, and maybe in a few years I see another show by the same artist and I understand it a lot better, or maybe I don't, you know, but I prefer not to be judgmental.
Over the years, has the kind of variety or diversity of artistic styles, has that changed?
Can't think of the answer. I think of something that occurs to me, in that I think that the work is not as diverse that one sees around as people make out, you know? Art history categorizes things and names, like, and makes up names for kinds of art, but later, usually. Everybody didn't call it abstract expressionism in 1949 or 1950, you know, but pretty soon they started, somebody thought that up, and that became what that's called, you know. And there's a certain kind of uniformity in the galleries. For instance, if you go around Chelsea, there's a certain, each gallery has an artist that does kind of colorful, painterly, abstract paintings. Each gallery has some photography. You know, each gallery has some dark rooms with some video in them, you know. And so there's certain, like, things that are uniform.
And is that because art critics back certain things?
I'm not sure that the art, you know, art critics are very influential, you know, especially in New York City, you know, but I'm not sure that they have the make or break kind of power as much as they used to, and it's a different situation because the art critics were more involved with groups of artists, with cliques of artists in the old days, you know. And now they're more involved with the galleries. They favor certain galleries, or they, you know, that's that sort of thing. And I don't know that art critics are very, I'm not sure how much contact they have with actual artists. They're more insulated now than they used to be. They used to move around amongst the rest of the world more than I think they do now.
Now, the galleries have gotten larger now, where the, you'll have a gallery that has five different branches all over the world.
Well, that kind of thing is new. You know, in the old days, there only was the Marlborough Gallery, for instance, that had more than one gallery in different places. You know, it was a very big gallery that would have a gallery in Europe and one in the United States and one in New York or something. And now they have as many as like 10 galleries all over creation, or 12 galleries, or I think there's one gallery that has 18 galleries.
And then also the spaces, you started to say the spaces
the
are much
spaces,
larger.
The physical spaces of galleries are much, much larger than they ever were. For instance, in the 70s, the gallery spaces were very modest compared to what they are now, you know, because the uptown spaces were in townhouses, you know, like a floor of a townhouse used to be a typical gallery, you know, and then in Soho, then the commercial, they moved into those industrial buildings, you know, those iron buildings in Soho, which had bigger spaces, and they were able to carve out bigger spaces.
Right.
And in Chelsea, it went like, you know, they moved in then to garages, which didn't have the same columns and the same space limitations, too, you know. So
now when you paint and work, you do that every day?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a sort of routine? I mean, the certain hours you devote to work?
Well, I like to start early in the morning, and I like to, you know, work as long as I can from early in the morning until, like, after 12 or so, you know, as long as I can without something interrupting and, you know, without interruption, because I find that's the quietest time that I have to work, and I think that my energy is better at that time of the morning, and I'm fresher to come to the work, you know. I like to give the painting my best energy, basically, and other things that other obligations that I have, I like to do later.
Do you work on one piece at a time, or do you have several going at the same time? How does that?
Well, I mostly have more than one thing going at a time, although I usually like to start something and finish it. You know, sometimes in one session. And certainly with works on paper, I often finish the same morning, you know, just start something and finish it. And with paintings, maybe if it's a very large painting, maybe it takes me 2 or 3 days, you know. But I paint relatively quickly, I think, compared to a lot of other people, because I like the effect of the freshness of a work that I've put down quickly and spontaneously.
Do you have a kind of concept when you start? I mean, you know that approximately what the painting is going to look like?
Well, I know, I guess sometimes I know what I want it to look like, and put it that way. It doesn't always pan out that way. But in some ways, the painting begins to dictate what it looks like once you get started making it, you know. And so I start out, I say, well, I want to make a painting of such and such, you know. And I have it in my head and what I want it to look like. But then the painting has a will of its own. And it takes you many times in other directions, and that's where the fun starts, really. Because otherwise it would be a more mechanical process, you know.
Right.
If you weren't discovering something that you didn't start out to know, you start out knowing, you know, well, then it would be a kind of a mechanical process. You'd just be making pictures and you wouldn't be painting,
uh-huh,
you know.
Uh-huh.
So making pictures is different than painting for me.
Do you always have a bunch of canvases or panels, whatever things are ready to go?
Well, I like to. I don't always. Sometimes I have to scurry around and dig something up, you know, to work on, and, you know. But I like to have a little batch of them prepared, you know, and when I get low with things that are gessoed and stretched or little panels that I've prepared, you know, well then I'd make some more, some more. I like to be ahead of that, but sometimes I run out.
You stretch your own canvases?
Yes. I've never really had a studio assistant. I've always done it all myself. I like that process of doing the drudgery part, too.
The whole thing is created from scratch or something. I mean, it is,
and it's, you know, somehow I find it. I don't know. It appeals to me to do my own preparation for the painting, you know, because you know one is always thinking, too, while you're doing that. You know, that's not exactly. It doesn't have to be a mindless sort of task.
Do you buy materials locally now?
Well, I have been, and one can order things, too. You know, I had two studios set up until August, you know, and I had everything that I need to work pretty much in Hudson, and I had everything that I need to work in New York City, you know. And so now I've combined these two studios of art materials. So I haven't had to buy very much in the last few months because I had so many things, you know, and I had duplicates of lots of things, you know. But I don't use a lot of materials in any case, though.
You have a favorite brand of oil colors, say?
No, I like lots of them. I like to try different ones, because they're all different, you know. None of them mix the colors exactly the same, and they have different colors, you know. I tend to go by what color that I find that I really think that sort of find exciting, you know. Because, you know, you look at a tube of paint, and it's very exciting when you find a new, very beautiful color. It's nice here in Hudson you can buy art materials and...
Yeah, now there are two places.
Two places to buy art materials, which is wonderful for a place this size, you know. Yeah. You know, I like to listen to music when I paint.
I thought that's true of a lot of artists, I think.
Is it?
Yeah.
Much more than talking. I don't, you know, I find that talking makes me sometimes nervous, especially they get on to politics or something, which then I get... it's not good for painting, and music that, you know, that I'm in the mood for that way. I think that's how I figure. Some days I want to hear a certain kind of music. Some days I want to hear a totally different kind, you know. But I think when you're listening to music and painting, the music takes you into a zone that you need to be in for your unconscious to do the painting, in a sense.
I know one painter who will get a certain piece of music that he'll use for, he'll be listening to for a long time, I mean for a period of days or weeks, you know,
I tend to do that too, you know. I get something that it gets into my head, you know, that I need it right then for some reason, you know. It's a need, I think. And different things satisfy one in different ways at different times.
When you grew up in Louisiana, was it the case that there was a lot of music around there?
I don't know. My parents used to have parties that people would come with musical instruments and play and this and that, you know. But I don't remember just everybody sitting around strumming banjos. Although they knew some, they had friends that were musicians and played, you know, lots of things, you know, and at parties and things, that sort of thing. But and then church music.
When you were in, when you were working for the gallery, did you have to do a lot of socializing with gallery clients?
Well, later I did. You know, when I first started working for the gallery, I did like the menial jobs, basically, you know. And I knew the clients because I had to, you know, I had to bring paintings out when people came to the showroom to see paintings. I had to carry them in and put them on the easel and show them to the customers. And Grace did the talking to the people, but I took the paintings in and out. And I delivered them to the people's houses when they bought something and that sort of thing. You know, we had a station wagon, and so I drove around to Long Island or Westchester or New Jersey or wherever it was that somebody lived and delivered things, you know. And so, you know, I knew them. I had been to lots of them's houses and that sort of thing. And I really did, since my ambition was really to be a painter and not an art dealer, you know, I didn't make much efforts to advance myself in the gallery. Later on, there was a point where Grace had a heart attack after we moved to Fifth Avenue. And it was shortly after the gallery moved, you know, and she was out of the gallery in the hospital for almost a year. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we had moved to a very expensive space and renovated, and it was a beautiful space, and we had incredible stable of artists. You know, we were handling the Milton Avery estate and Max Beckman estate and Stuart Davis estate, amongst others, you know, and we had customers coming and going, you know. And one day, you know, all of a sudden Grace wasn't there, and Grace had done most of the selling in the gallery before that. And somebody just pushed me into the showroom. There were people in there that wanted to buy things. And they said, you know those people, you've been to their house. You know, you go talk to them, you know. Like, and that's how I started, like, doing selling things. And that's how I started being an art dealer. Is that somebody pushed me in the showroom with a customer one day when there wasn't anybody else. I was like the low man on the totem pole, but there was a very short totem pole, so, you know, I had to fill in, you know. Uh-huh. And we had always been that kind of organization that we all did everything. Grace would help me to pack something sometimes, or, you know, this and that, and we would go together to deliver things often, and you know, she would clean with me and things. If, you know, we all sort of did everything, whatever was needed, you know. It was a, you know, more of an organization like that. You know, it wasn't quite as hierarchical as galleries tend to be now. So, you know, I knew things that Grace had said to people, and I knew all the artists, and I knew our inventory backwards and forwards. Uh-huh, you know, I knew every scrap of paper that we had, every drawing, every print, every painting that we had. I knew all about it because I had inventoried them all when they came to the gallery. You know, so I probably knew our inventory better than anybody.
And the inventory was
one of Willie Loman's rules of salesmen.
Oh, yes.
Know your inventory.
This inventory was large then also. Oh,
quite large. We had from, you know, maybe 28 to 35 artists or estates at a time. You know, so, you know, in each one we had a good selection of their works, you know, so that's quite a, and we also had a secondary market kind of business that we did in German Expressionist art.
When you use the term secondary market, what does that mean exactly?
Well, that means the artworks that we got from artists, our artist estates, that would be called a primary market. And secondary market would be things that had been sold many years ago and we had for resale.
And so for that market, I guess you're dealing not only with individuals, but maybe museums and that sort of thing.
Museums, that's right. And there was a lot of German art came to this country with the German artist, with the European artist, you know, fleeing the Second World War and fleeing the Nazis. And so in the 1980s, by the 1970s and 80s, the German economy and the European economies had recovered from the war, essentially, you know, and they were doing quite well by that time, and the collectors, the European collectors, wanted to repatriate a lot of the kind of art that had ended up in America, you know. So quite often we had collectors who had brought things from Europe, you know, when they escaped the Nazis and the occupation in France, or the Nazis in Germany, and had come to a point of being ready to sell things, and the things were often bought back by European collectors.
So the war had a lot to do with New York becoming a art capital, perhaps.
Absolutely, absolutely, because so many, you know, world-famous artists came to New York, you know, at that time. But not only artists, you know, the artists were the higher-profile people who came to New York, but we have to remember that collectors came to New York to live, or to America to live, and also a great number of people, museum people, who happened to be, you know, on the wrong side of the Nazis, and the people, everybody from the European modern art scene had to leave practically. You know, very few people could coexist if they had had a high profile, you know, with the modern art, because it was anathema to the Nazis, you know, and threatening to the Nazis, essentially. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people, they knew somebody in New York, so a lot of them went there if they could, you know. And it became a place for European immigrants to, you know, to settle, and was a comfortable place for them to settle in America, I think, you know, a place that was compatible for them.
Right, it was already a cosmopolitan place.
That's right. There were people from all over, and every country had a community, had a sort of community, every group of people that, you know, every group of immigrants already had people there, sort of, too.
Right, you could buy the food.
You could know the people that, you know, some of the same people you knew in you know, in Europe, you know, are the same kinds of people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was, and that contributed hugely to the American art world, because the American art, the New York art world was very, very small before that. Just a few galleries, and most of them specialized in European art, you know.
It was sort of in the 1950s that American art kind of came to the fore, right?
That's right. Well, before the 1950s, I mean, a friend of Milton Avery once talked to me about that generation of artists, you know, and he was an elderly man. And he said, I'll never forget what he said to me, because he said, he was a collector who lived over in Massachusetts. His name was Mark Futter. And he had been a German immigré, you know. But he had collected Avery, and he was a good friend of Avery. And he said to me, he said, for artists of Avery's generation, Avery was born in 1885, you know. And he said, for artists, American artists of that generation, to be an American artist was to be nobody, because the galleries in America only handled European art, and the collectors in America only thought that European art was top, first rate. You know, and everything American was considered kind of second rate in terms of that. And that generation of artists got clobbered by World War I, the Depression, and World War II. You know, they lived through these three, like, huge cataclysms where there was no art world, you know, where there was no art market. And not until the 50s was American art considered something important. I do know that the government, you know, in general, they used abstract art after the war to show what a forward-thinking country the United States was.
Oh, yes.
And
oh.
They sent exhibitions of this new art to the embassies in other countries and to museums in other countries, and the government was very supportive of a certain kind of avant-garde American art after the war because it was helpful to the image of the country.
Right,
you
right,
know,
right.
That we were, you know, a younger country than others, but that we had this new kind of exciting kind of art. You know, so
yeah.
it was beneficial politically at that time.
Well, this has been very interesting. I learned all sorts of things from you today, Mac.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming.
It was a pleasure to talk to you, as always.